Remaker's Mark, Episode 59, The Book of Eli. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in our 59th episode, where we are once again discussing Denzel Washington's vehicle, the Chevy Impala. No, I'm just kidding. It's the Book of Eli. With me, as always, are Andy Wicks. Andy, what is your favorite fried chicken selling establishment?
I'm well. And you could also call this a Jennifer Beals vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm going to go with that one, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Not a big fried chicken guy. So I choose to abstain.
I bid you good day.
Wasn't this your suggestion of a question?
No, it certainly was not. Why would I choose
mine.
This?
Okay.
It's a perfectly fine answer, you son of a bleep. Jeremy Nielsen.
I'm going to choose a question for which I have no answer, Jer.
Well, stranger things have happened.
That's true.
Jeremy Nielsen, how are you tonight, and what is your favorite fried chicken establishment?
I am well, and I'm going to have to narrow it down to favorite fried chicken sandwich restaurant.
Ooh, yeah.
And I'm going to go with Popeyes.
Ooh, okay. Nice. I've still not had that.
I found out the secret. They marinate the chicken in pickle juice.
And they have 12 herbs and spices.
Nice. I have also marinated the chicken breasts in pickle juice and made them at home, and they are outstanding.
Interesting. Fried at home as well, or just in general?
Then I would make a little a batter and batter fry them. Yeah.
Nice.
So made an actual legit chicken sandwich.
Right on. I will have to try that. I don't like pickles, but the brining intrigues me. Lee Handwipes, how are you tonight, and what is your favorite fried chicken establishment?
I'm well, and I don't eat a lot of fried chicken myself either, but the fried chicken that they have at the deli at Byerly's is pretty good.
Yeah, it's true. Good call. Mark Josting, how are you, and what is your favorite fried chicken establishment?
I'm very well, thank you. And, you know, dadgummit, I'm also going to go with Popeyes.
Nice.
It is crispy and delicious, and it has just enough heat. It's a wonderful chicken.
Right on. Boy, I got to try that now. I'll have to make that happen. I know for a while there, they had like a spicy chicken sandwich, I think, that was like all the rage, right, pre-COVID. That was like everybody was trying to get it, and there were lines up the wazoo. So, turns out people like it. Who knew? My name is Kyle Delahunt. I will be your host once again this fine evening. I'll give two answers. Favorite fried chicken food would be they have a fried chicken sandwich at World Street Kitchen that is phenomenal. My favorite kind of like just general fried chicken establishment is Revival. They've got one in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul, and it is so good. And they're at the place right next to Jer's house, which is great. Don't be creepy. Very good. Jer, this was your pick. The Book of Eli, I should say, was your pick. So you get the Remaker's Mark recommendation. Hit us up.
Absolutely. So as the keeper of the archives, I have logged all of our past recommends, which seems to skew largely towards podcasts with the occasional movie, TV show, another thing. We have gone a little bit out into center field with Andy recommending a building at one point.
It was an institution, Jeremy.
That's true.
An institution. Mark recommended a lecture series, if I remember.
I'm not surprised.
Which I think we're also, like, you could get on podcast form, really.
Right? Sure. So I want to go a little bit out there, and I want to recommend to you all Brussels sprouts.
Hey!
Interesting.
This isn't
I already like those.
Well, I'm glad that I'm rubbing off on you guys. This isn't like a, oh, shoot, I forgot to think of something and punt. I thought of this a week ago, and I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. I have just been loving Brussels sprouts lately, and I feel like they got a really bad rap with this whole, like, kids hate Brussels sprouts, and so if you don't do your homework, you have to eat Brussels sprouts. Like, they have sort of been villainized in kid culture, but they're really, really good. And
how do you prefer to have them served?
So my favorite recipe that I've found thus far is a Brussels sprout potato salad.
Oh.
and you saute the Brussels sprouts, and there's a mustard vinaigrette that you pour over them and the potatoes.
Tell me
it
more.
Is so good.
Mm. I actually roast mine.
I agree with you, Jer, on several factors. A, that a lot of really, really good vegetables gained an unfair punitive connotation when we were kids. And second, my mother, I love her dearly, and I think she's a great mother, but she really did not know how to serve a lot of vegetables when I was a kid. And she just seemed to like steam them to the point of them being
mush.
Mush.
Yeah.
And nothing as good as mush.
No.
But when I finally had
except
like
for perhaps mushed potatoes.
Well, okay. Mm.
Fair. Maybe apple
exception,
sauce.
You know, apple every sauce. Good rule has a good exception. But yeah, the first time I had, I think like sauteed Brussels sprouts or like grilled asparagus.
Yeah. You know,
like, oh my God. And seeing Brussels sprouts at the farmer's market, how they come on that giant stalk.
Right.
Super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an amazing food. And yeah. I actually was blessed, well, maybe blessed or cursed, either one. I never had them growing up. I just knew of them as this sort of like, kind of food that that I should avoid as a kid. But my mom never made them. We never had them. We had asparagus a ton because we grew it in the yard. But Brussels sprouts were sort of an invisible thing to us. And so it wasn't until I was an adult and I was like, that's what these are? These are amazing. And so they're one of my favorite vegetables now. So Brussels sprouts.
Amazing.
I think it's fantastic.
Jer, mm-hmm. That is a great recommendation.
I think that's fantastic.
It's both specific and broad, and I like that about it. Well done. Nice work. Well, next, I am going to be talking about what our next movie is going to be. And I am so excited about this. One of the people, so I started by focusing on filmmakers because, you know, unfortunately, the list of African-American or Black or people of color filmmakers is not great, right? It's not a huge list. It's not never ending. So you can really, you know, do a search for greatest Black filmmakers and, you know, it's a top 25 list. It's not a top 100. I mean, it's unfortunate that that is the case, but that is the case. And so the person that I focused on was someone who is an incredible acting talent who also did directing, and that was Sidney Poitier. And so I was like, you know what? I want to pick a Sidney Poitier movie. And then
I can know where this is going.
I realized that all of his movies are super goofy. And I was like, wow, that's really weird. I did not see that with him. And one stuck out to me, and that is Stir Crazy with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor.
I knew it.
What?
He directed that?
That was going to be my second choice.
Yeah,
he directed Book of Eli.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I had initially picked that one, and then I figured somebody else is going to pick this, so I chose something else. So I'm really glad that you did.
It's on my list, too.
Awesome. I have never seen it. I totally don't. I mean, I know of it, but I don't know it. And I am just like giddy as all get out in the idea of recasting Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. It is going to be so hard and so amazing. The trailer looks terrible, but trailers always did for this era. So yeah, I am pretty darn jazzed. This is from 1980. I looked at some of his other ones and just realized that almost all of them have Bill Cosby in them. And I'm like, you know, I'm not going to go there. No, thank you. I'm good without that. Thank you. And you know, again, Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. That's really all you need to know. So Stir Crazy, directed by Sidney Poitier from 1980, will be our next film.
Excellent. I've seen several, Gene Wilder, Richard Pryor team up movies, but I have not seen this one.
Yeah. I think I've just seen See No Evil, Hear No Evil. I don't know if I've seen
that's the one I remember the most.
Yeah.
That's the classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited.
Right on. Me too. Yay. Very good. I'm glad you guys are excited. When I saw that, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. I'm intrigued as all get out. All right. So before we dig into the deep discussion of Book of Eli, let's do a quick recap of how our casting or recasting of the film went. So we had three major characters and five minor characters. We're going to go through the winners in all these areas. The first major character was that of Carnegie, originally played by Gary Oldman. We went with Mark's choice of Ewan McGregor. Yay. Good job. Then in the role of Solara, originally played by Mila Kunis, we went with Andy's choice of Millie Bobby Brown. Very good. Well done.
Yay.
And finally, the major role of Eli, originally played by the one, the only Denzel Washington. We went with Mark's choice of Idris Elba. Doesn't fall far from the Denzel Washington tree. And I like it.
I actually thought about John Boyega because he looks like a young Denzel Washington.
That's really good. Yeah. That's really good. I like that.
Also, to follow up on our discussion on Ewan McGregor, I have, since we recorded that episode, I watched Birds of Prey as him as a villain. I'm into it.
Yeah, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. It's big. It's a big performance.
It's something.
Sure.
It's something.
Yes. Right on. And then finally, the minor characters, the roles of George and Martha, originally played by Michael Gambon and Francis de la Tour. We went with Andy's choices of Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn.
Yay.
A dynamic duo, if ever there was one.
Yay.
Excellent. Well, now let us dig into Book of Eli a bit more. So we've recast the film. Now let's talk about the film as a whole. What we liked about it, the story, the setting, things that we would maybe change, things we would do differently, etc. The first of those is kind of digging into the apocalypse nature of it, or the apocalypse-ness-osity, if you will. That is very hard to say, and I'm okay with that. Jer, you started that discussion when we talked about this previously. Do you mind starting that off here and we can all chime in as well?
Absolutely. So we talked about it in the first episode, but this movie came out sort of in the midst of a lot of different apocalypse-based movies and TV shows. I think this was right around when Walking Dead was starting to air and The Road came out, and there were a few other ones. So it was kind of in this, it was almost like white noise when it came out as far as what was also coming out. But I feel like what separated this movie from a lot of the other ones is that it almost feels a little mythological at points. And I think that to its benefit and to its detriment, it waffles between a very real feeling post-apocalyptic environment where, you know, these small towns are cropping up and people are using catgut for chapstick and whatever else, and books are valuable commodities and water is a valuable commodity. Like those all make sense to me as far as what would happen. But then you have sort of this mythological idea of Denzel Washington's character and sort of his hero's journey of sorts, and the way he fights and the way that he carries himself is very much out of sort of the realism of the whole thing. So I think that the movie itself didn't quite know what it wanted to be out of all of that. And I think that's one of its problems. And I don't hate either one of those two things. I like the realism of it, but I also like this sort of mythological approach to the story, especially with a story that sort of centers on faith and religion and theology and spirituality or what have you. And so I like that the characters kind of end up a little bit bigger than life, but I think that it never really found its footing as far as what it wanted to ultimately be.
I think one of the things that could either be seen as a strength or a weakness of it is that they don't really talk about how it became, like, what the apocalypse was. They refer to it very vaguely, right? They talk about, like, a white light, but I don't really think there was anything else, was there?
Yeah, I think that they use that sort of explosion or whatever it was as a way to show that there was blindness post-apocalypse, and then there was people who are blind that were born blind before it all happened. And so there was allowed to create that sort of duality of that. But what was that? A nuclear explosion? Was it some sort of asteroid? Like, yeah, they don't really explain any of that besides that there was a giant blinding light.
So do you, the royal you, everybody here, whoever wants to chime in, do you feel like that is something that is a strength of the movie that they don't talk about it, or do you think that would have made it better?
I like it.
Yeah.
I think it's rather beside the point of the movie, and I'm glad they don't dwell on it. I mean, they could have put a lot of history into it, and it's that can be done in a way that that helps out the movie, but I don't think it would have been necessary here.
To compare it to Fury Road, for example, Fury Road has that whole montage of headlines and news clippings and whatever else of sort of explaining how the world tore itself apart. And it was the typical stuff. It was war. It was superpowers fighting over oil and everything else. But I don't think that that movie would be any less good if you took all of that out at the beginning.
Man, I totally don't remember that from Fury Road. That's funny.
It's the opening credits, basically.
Oh, okay. Got it. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, I think I'd agree with you that it's fine to keep it vague. You know, I think that's okay. If they would have added it, I don't know that it would have taken away from it. It might have if they go too heavy-handed with it. It's interesting, Jer, that you talk about kind of the blindness that results from that, in that I think that can, you know, that can have a sort of a biblical or a theological vibe to it as well. You know, once was blind, now can see, or, blindness certainly has a piece in biblical literature as well. So, you know, you kind of have that tying in too.
And I do like that they used that sort of idea of blindness and light and brightness in how they shot the movie and the cinematography of it. Everything was very washed out. The colors were very muted for the most part. Everything, like, you almost felt like you were squinting for most of the movie as you watched it.
That's a great way to describe it. Yeah, that's spot on. We're going to get to the style a little bit later, so we won't delve on that too much. The other piece of this, in addition to kind of the apocalyptic nature of it, is the fact that it is, you know, essentially in its own right, not explicitly, kind of a Christian movie, if you will. Now, that can be seen in many, many different ways, just like you can say about Christian music, which is, of course, all awful. No, I'm just kidding. There's really good Christian music out there. But, you know, I think if you were to say that, I don't think anybody would be like, you know, aside from Rod and Todd Flanders, like, yay, Christian movie. It's not a compelling genre, shall we say. But that said, I thought it was very interesting the way that they sort of took that and, you know, made a modern contemporary film with that. What do you guys have to say about that? Is that something that was compelling to you? Was it just part of the whole deal, so you didn't really, you know, think about it too much? How did that pan out for you?
I would flatly disagree that it's a Christian movie.
And I agree with Mark.
Yeah. Ooh. The fact that it's that the book is a Bible, you know, maybe it's significant, but the book is really a MacGuffin. I don't think it's really important, you know, what it is. It just happens to be a book, and the book happens to be the Bible.
Yeah, that's cool.
I agree with Mark in that there is no... To call it a Christian movie implies that there's a theology, an allegory, a moral tale, whatever unnecessary baggage you want to attach to the label. But like Mark said, the Bible is simply a MacGuffin. And I think the book could have been any tome, any religious tome. It could have been any book, any, you know, profound book from before the apocalypse. I think that the theme that I got out of it was that what Carnegie saw in that book was not salvation of his eternal soul or whatever. He saw power. He saw religion as an opiate for the masses and a way to control the town. I think he would have been equally happy had that book been a Quran. A book would have been any other sort of religious tome that he could have used as a guide for the people, a moral guide, a message from on high, you know, whatever you want to call it, to give the people something to hold on to and to see him as the person who delivered it, therefore entrusting him with power. So that's really all I felt was the message of the book of Eli being simply the fact that Eli had this book that he felt was important for one reason. Carnegie saw the book important for a different reason, hence the conflict. Hence the ensuing hilarity, I agree with Mark that I wouldn't even call it a religious movie. I think that that's simply just a storytelling tool.
And I think that Carnegie could be better served by the book if it were maybe The Art of War or The Prince by Machiavelli.
Do you guys remember what book he was reading when you first see him? Do you recall that?
It's
Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal.
No, it's not. Is it Machiavelli?
It's Mussolini.
Mussolini.
I was like, in my notes, I was like, of course the villain is reading a book by Mussolini when you see him. Like, come on.
I think he could have done really well with like Eat, Pray, Love or, you know.
Yeah. Chicken Soup for the Soul.
The Prayer of Jabez.
Cat Gut for the Soul.
I mean, there's a lot of options out there.
That's Penthouse true. Forum.
Playboy for the articles. Really, but it also goes back to the point of that we kind of talked about, I think, a little bit in the first part, the first episode, that literacy is king, is power. And he's one of the few literate people around. So simply that in itself, I mean, he could have gotten a copy of, you know, a cookbook and probably figured out a way to make that help him stay in power.
Well, I think that to piggyback off of what you and Mark said, I think that this isn't a movie about spirituality in a theological sense, but I think that it does speak to a lot of contemporary themes of religion, in that and how we see, especially now, not to get too political, but how we see the Bible being used as a tool of power grasping, as opposed to what it's intended to be used for. And I think that there's a lot of parallels between where we see sort of contemporary conservative Christianity today and how Carnegie sought to use faith or sought to use the text to better his position.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most publicity that a Bible has had in the last year was Donald Trump holding it like supposedly a human holds a Bible at a photo op in front of the church near the White House. Like, I am here how I hold Bible.
Can you imagine him human. Being pictured trying to hold a baby?
No, I can't. I'm pretty sure he never has.
Without eating it?
Oh, Lordy. Well, I appreciate your chiming in on that, everybody there. It makes me realize that I think you could probably say the same thing about like Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Like, it's a movie that features a relic of the Christian religion, I suppose, but it is not like a Christian movie, right? It's just like a piece of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd probably say that's more of a Jewish movie if you're going to go that far.
But yeah, fair. Yeah,
that's true. I think there's a lot of movies that have either overt or covert Christian themes in them, and that whole sort of classic Christ metaphor in them. But yeah, I wouldn't call any of them Christian movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that this is in that boat. I think there's a lot of themes to it that you could pull from. It's one of those movies back in my church youth director days, this would be the type of movie that I would pull something out of for some type of Bible study or whatever, but not the movie as a whole, because obviously Denzel Washington kills a bunch of dudes. he's not Jesus.
It's very Old Testament.
Yeah, agreed, Jer. Good call. So we've touched on it a little bit, but let's continue our discussion of the style of the movie. Mark, you've chimed in a little bit. Do you mind talking a little bit about what the film looks like and what your thought of it was and maybe sounds like too?
Yeah, Jer mentioned a little bit about how washed out the movie is. And yeah, the visuals, very like overexposed, which, you know, we're all photography people here. And I know I love that. The colors are also very just desaturated. It is a very visually stylistic movie, which I pretty uniformly dig. And I think one of the most stunning sequences is the one where Denzel's character hunts a cat.
Well, at the opening.
Yeah, the opening sequence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great scene. Holy cow.
Yeah, it is beautiful. But yes, I was really impressed with the visuals of this movie. and really got into it just from the first, from the cat hunting.
What I love about that scene too is that it starts off as it's sort of kind of panning over this forest scape, and you think, oh, it's like a peaceful snow falling in the woods, and then you realize that it's not snow, it's ash, the world is dead, and he's hunting a cat. And it's like you get every sense of how this world is in that one little sequence. Mm-hmm. And it's just so beautifully shot, and the ways that they use color and tone is just so good. It's a great opening.
Do you feel like it ever took you out of the movie in a way, or did you feel like that gave you a hard time at all, or was it pretty across the board appreciated?
Personally, I just loved it the whole time.
I liked how they used both light and shadow with a couple different scenes where, like, Denzel went under that bridge and they had that little fight scene. I thought that was a really cool way. When you go back and watch it again, knowing that he's blind, like, he goes into that area to sort of give them a negative that he doesn't have in the dark, even though it's, you know, blazing bright outside, so it wouldn't be that dark. But the contrast of light and shadow, and yeah, like I said before, just the whole feeling that you're squinting through most of the movie, and how powerful that was. Like, I really appreciated their cinematography.
I kind of did the sort of cartoon thing where you sort of like rub your eyes like, right? Like that kind of thing. And I was like, is this wrong? Like, is something wrong? And I was like, okay, I think this is on purpose. But at first I was definitely like, boy, did I really do a bad job of copying this movie over? Like, you know, like, or when I ripped it to video, I don't know. But yeah, it ultimately I believed it, you know, I came to like it. But first little bit, I was like, what's going on here?
Kyle, if your eyes make that noise when you rub them, you might want to get some drops.
Oh, I forgot to take my glasses off. That's why they went eerie. Yeah, I was just rubbing my glasses, which is not terribly helpful. In fact, it makes it worse.
Beyond the visuals, I also really, really loved the soundtrack of this movie. There were some good songs from his iPod, but then also just that sort of quiet, sort of haunting strings that kind of purvey through that. I really appreciated that. And I could see in a remake of this movie, I would love to have Trent Reznor or somebody along those lines do something with that, because it was really, really good. And I like it a lot.
Hey, Jared, do you know who did the soundtrack?
Oh, no. Was it Trent Reznor?
No, but it was Atticus Ross, who is Reznor's left-hand man now on Nine Inch Nails and soundtracks.
It's Trent Reznor 1.5.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is now I'm realizing how much of that is Atticus versus Trent. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, like,
I mean, I've listened to like every Nine Inch Nails thing 100 times, right? But it's when you're dealing in a completely different world, you know, as far as like film composing goes, I didn't know what Trent was doing in that. And I'm sure it's still a lot. I think they have very similar aesthetics in a lot of ways, but this was so much of that style that it made really good sense to me that that was how it was, and that it was Atticus Ross that did that.
So I take it back. Don't change a thing. Just hire him again for the remake.
Well, you know, Trent could bring his own influence in there. That's good.
Yeah.
I thought the sound design was really cool, and it informs, or sorry, let me rephrase that. You finding out what you do about Denzel's character informs that sound design, because it's a pretty extreme surround sound experience. They really use the surround sound channels a lot, to the point where it would kind of be like, if this was your first movie mix, they'd be like, okay, buddy, now take what you did and then shrink it in a little bit, right? Like it's a lot. But at the same time, later on, you're like, oh, like that so much informs how he, you know, takes in the world. Like it makes perfect sense in that regard. And I thought it was really cool.
I mentioned this in the first episode, but I really think this movie benefits from a second viewing after you have seen the entirety of it.
Yeah. I haven't had a chance to yet, but I agree. I will do my darndest to do that. So as we usually do, and while we have talked about recasting the film, let's talk about, you know, the original cast. First and foremost, certainly, is that of Eli. Mark, you talk about Eli being a very interesting character. Can you delve into that a little bit more?
Sure. My first impression of Eli when I started the form one was basically that I was watching a samurai movie. That he really reminds me of the old Japanese Ronin characters. Like he's an obvious badass, and he's stoic and unapproachable. But turns out he's got a heart of gold. I tend to like that character, and I like Eli too. Maybe it's because I watch a lot of Japanese media. But yeah, I was really intrigued by him. And it kind of fit into this mold for me that I really appreciate, that I'm really familiar with. And I think I liked it a lot.
Yeah, they really did a good job of sort of weaving the classic Old West movie and classic, like you said, Ronin movie. Like both of those themes are very much sort of intermingled in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Lee, you've been pretty quiet. What did you feel about Eli as a character, as a performance? What did that, how did that kind of hit for you?
Well, I thought it was an interesting performance. I'll admit that the fact that he was blind didn't dawn on me at the end. That was something that I discovered when we had our first discussion, but that makes me want to go back and rewatch it. I think maybe there were some scenes where it just didn't catch it, I guess. And I think at the end, it didn't feel like it really explained it all that well that he was blind. I just thought that he just understood Braille. Like he could just read Braille for some reason.
Yeah, it wasn't perfectly clear. I agree. I didn't know it until somebody that I work with mentioned it. So it was not perfectly clear. And I think, Andy, I think you were in the same place too.
I'm still not convinced.
Yeah.
But that aside, I mean, I liked it. I liked the performance of everybody in the movie. And I mean, especially Denzel. I mean, you can hardly go wrong with anything that he does. And I thought he was a very sympathetic character, and I was rooting for him the entire time, even though, you know, he had to do questionable things at times. It's like you're still rooting for him. So, yeah, I very much enjoyed the performances.
Right on. Andy, how about you?
I enjoyed the performances. Are we speaking specifically of Denzel, or are we talking about all of them?
We can broaden out if you'd like. I'm cool with that.
I think enough has been said about Denzel. I mean, really, is enough ever said about Denzel? But enough has been said about Denzel in this movie. I liked almost all of the performances. I've never been a big Mila Kunis fan. I don't know. Just doesn't do it for me. And I don't think it was a terrible job. I just felt like it was the weak link in this chain.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised and pleased with Jennifer Beals for a small role. I thought there was actually... And she's another one of those characters where... I wish there was more of her in the movie, more of that character, because I think it got really interesting towards the end when her kind of moment, the I can smell your wound or whatever she said there, is like, oh, yeah, man, that was a cool moment. And I kind of wish there was a little bit more of that.
Also gross.
Yeah, super gross, yeah. Which also made me think of then Will Ferrell's character in Austin Powers, but
yes.
Which then made me giggle and made me enjoy the scene even more. I think the performances I really, really enjoyed. I thought a lot of the little roles were good. Michael Gambon and Francis de la Tour, I thought, were amazing. That whole little scene, I enjoyed every bit of it from the very beginning. I think if there's one other character I didn't like, it was the right-hand man to Carnegie, who for some reason had the very...
Redridge?
Yeah, Redridge. I don't understand why he talked the way he did. Like he whispered or he had a very breathy voice kind of going on.
Yeah,
I think he was in training for a Batman type character for the town.
It kind of felt like yes. That, and I wasn't sure why. It seemed like an unnecessary little flair for the character. Like he was already menacing and he's actually a voice actor. That guy's a voice actor who does some pretty cool stuff. So it was like, so why not let him use his voice anyhow? Jennifer Beals for president.
It's too late.
Is it?
Yep. You never know.
Yeah. So I think that with regards to the blindness thing, I think that the movie did not do a great job of explaining it at the end or revealing it. I did think that the movie did a pretty good job of giving you clues along the way that to go back to. However, it doesn't explain at all how he is able to do all of the things that, like, this is going back to that sort of mythological component of it. Like, there's no way, even if you have been blind your entire life, there's no way that he could fight the way that he did and shoot snipers off of the rooftop with a handgun because he heard them, you know, cock their gun or whatever. Like, there is sort of that mythology to it. And then it's also like he runs into tables and, you know, can't quite, like, he has to search a little bit with his hands to find the things around him. So it's like he's blind, but he's also superhuman. And it's one of those things that the movie didn't ever decide where it was going.
Excuse me. When he gets into that abandoned house towards the beginning of the movie and he opens the door to the closet or whatever, and there's the dead body hanging.
Yep.
He reacts like he's visually startled. Like, he jumps back a little bit.
I think that he is reacting to the smell. If you watch it again, I think he's reacting to the smell of opening that. And because he kind of turns his head in a way that it's like repulsed by the smell. But then he doesn't, like, you kind of see him reach out and, like, figure out what is in there and then find the boots on the person and take their boots.
All right. Then I will use one more counterpoint if you're going to go with the smell argument.
Keep it coming.
Because I'm still not convinced.
We can do this all day.
This is fun. Then there's the scene where he's walking along, which, again, he can follow a road really well. And there's the woman who is the little ambush trap. And she's, what is she, chained to a grocery cart or something? I'd have never figured out what's going on with that one. She's terrible bait. But then he's like, oh, one thing about the apocalypse is you can smell people from a mile away.
Right.
So if he could smell them from a mile away, why couldn't he smell the hanging body till he opened the door? Come on.
Doors have a very...
Talk about plot holes.
Impenetrable.
Zero stars.
like I said, it doesn't do a great job of explaining where
In
things
our
go.
Remake, we would clarify this very obviously. Right. He needs a seeing eye dog or something. Actually, that would be kind of a cool addition, a seeing eye dog that could, like, fight in the fights, too.
Yeah. I was thinking that it would have been really interesting to actually cast a blind person in this role, but then I feel like the reveal would not have been there because it would have been more obvious.
Oh, my pick might have been really good.
Your pick is great, yeah.
So my proposal is... a Harry Potter based explanation of things, which is
I'm listening
in I th-
magic?
Think kinda in Harry Potter 3 when Ron thinks he's been given the juice, the potion that Harry had that basically, like, makes you get away with anything, but he didn't actually have it.
Harry Potter and the Goblet of the Phoenix.
Goblet of Fire.
You just did a mashup, buddy. That's okay.
The Sorcerer's Hallows?
Chamber of Magic.
The Deathly Sorcerer. I think you're right. I think it is Goblet of Fire.
Harry Potter Hits Puberty? It's that one.
Oh, are you there, God? It's me, Harry Potter.
Harry Potter and the Unchained Melody.
Encyclopedia Potter.
These are the mashups we didn't know we needed.
Seriously, it's so good. Anyways, so he goes out onto the Quidditch field?
Pitch.
It's a pitch.
Thank
Kyle.
You. Yes, sorry. Had my Britishisms confused. And just kills it, right? Because he thinks he can get away with anything. The book is the placebo. The book is that potion. Like, he is so blinded by his faith and the mission that he has received that essentially he can do anything. Like, that is his potion. So, boom.
He essentially thinks he's divinely protected and has no reason to fear.
Yeah.
Or maybe he is divinely protected, and that's something that the movie kind of leaves ambiguous too. Like, was God allowing him to get this book to a marooned ship to be preserved, or was that his belief in that was what powered him through all of that?
I'm inclined like to, yeah, I'm inclined to go with that, Jer, that that he actually is superhuman. I mean, I think there are a few explanations for how he can get shot in the stomach and then, you know, walk for miles and miles.
Yeah.
I think that's perfectly fair. Agreed.
And I like the movie for making him superhuman.
Yeah, it goes back to what you said, Mark, about the sort of Ronin stories of them. Like it felt a lot like that, in that they are kind of on a plane above everything else.
Mm-hmm.
One small question that is somewhat touching into performances, but what did you guys think of the fight choreography?
I enjoyed it.
Okay. Usually not saying anything is a good thing. So I will take the relative silence of that as like, oh, it was actually pretty good. Like usually when fight choreography is bad, it leaves a greater impact than when it is good, except for something like The Matrix or something like that, right? Where it was just like so, one, copycat, admittedly, but two, like groundbreaking, right? Like just so unlike anything that you had ever seen unless you watched every kung fu movie like the Wachowskis did, right?
I think so. That I would say that the photography or the cinema, the choreography, there we go, mm-hmm. was good enough that it didn't stand out as being flawed. Like it wasn't obviously like, oh, that's terrible fight choreography, that's terrible photography. So I think it's interesting that you bring up The Matrix, because I think that choreography was so groundbreaking to so much of the American audience in a mainstream movie to see that kind of wire work and camera work in kind of a mainstream movie was something that I think a lot of people hadn't seen. And so it became very well known for that reason. And then a lot of movies since then took elements of that, and then it kind of became more mainstream. And now it's less mind blowing when you see it. It's a little more like, oh yeah, it's just another good action movie. Which is unfortunate, because I'm sure the work that it takes to make that choreography happen is monstrous.
Yeah.
So all that to say, I felt the choreography was great. I mean, I enjoyed the fight scenes. I didn't see them as giant flaws in the film.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And like I said before, I really liked specifically like that under the bridge scene. It was very beautifully shot. I'm a sucker for any fight scene in silhouette.
Oh, yeah. Good call.
Kill Bill does the same thing.
And yeah.
Several other movies, and I'm just a sucker for it.
Yep, me too. I'm right there with you. All right, last but not least, let us rate the film. So we're going to do this as usual on a 1 to 10 scale, 1 being the worst movie you've ever seen, 10 being the greatest movie you've ever seen, and a scale of your choosing. Jer, let's start with you. This was your movie. What did you think of it? What was your rating?
Yeah, I chose this because I felt, like I said in the first episode, that this is a movie that could stand to be improved upon. Not quite to the degree that Supergirl needed, but I felt like a better version of this movie exists somewhere, and we could help make that happen. That being said, I still really like this movie. There's a lot that I really enjoy about it. I'm going to give it 8 out of 10, and I'll steal some low-hanging fruit here. 8 out of 10 Kentucky Fried Chicken naplets, whatever those things are called.
Wet naps. Handy wipes.
Handy wipes.
Handy wipes, yeah. All right. It's good low-hanging fruit. I hope you wixed somebody. Lee, on to you. What was your rating and scale of the film?
I enjoyed it too, and it's something that I think I'll go back and watch again, just to, if for no other reason, to see all those little clues that point to him being blind. but I will give it 7.5 severed hands.
Because there's about that many in the movie, I would say. I think that's actually a fair shake.
Nice. Yeah, this is Star Wars level of loss of limbs.
Yeah. It's a little bloodier, but yeah, agreed. Mark, on to you. What would be your rating and scale?
I quite enjoyed this film. And I think I'm going to give it 8.5 vials of cat oil.
Mmm, gross. You could get a good rate on that.
Dang it, Mark, you stole mine.
You were going to go last for a reason, Mr. Wicks. Let's see if I can like triple Wicks you here.
It's only fair.
I know. I will go next. This movie I enjoyed when I first watched it. And the more that I talked about it with people, the more passionate those people were, got me into it more. Like everybody I talked to was like, hey, I really, really liked that movie. And I was kind of surprised, not in a way that it was bad, but it was just like they liked it more than just like passive enjoyment would have. Like, eh, it was fine. And so because of that, I liked it more, and talking about it more made me like it more. You know, it's one of those things where like the more you dig into it, the more you ask about it, you like it more, which is not always the case. So for me, I would give it probably 7.5 hand cramps. Because boy, Malcolm McDowell at the end, he seems to be writing for about 6 weeks straight. that's just got to be tiring. There's got to be some, maybe they've got like a masseuse on staff or something.
Talk about carpal tunnel syndrome.
Seriously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is rough. That is a lot of work. Andy, close us off here.
Okay. I also enjoyed this movie. I agree. I think it could be made better, but it was better than I expected it going into it. I will give this one 7.9 gangrenous wounds.
You can smell
those almonds.
Yep. Excellent and disgusting. I like it. All right, cool. Well, thanks for chatting about that with us, gentlemen. That was a lot of fun, and I hope you all enjoyed it as well. If you haven't seen the movie, please definitely do so. It is quite good, as you can tell by our ratings. So to close it out, Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all of the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including Google Play and Apple Podcasts, where you can rate and review Remakers Mark, which would mean the world to us. You can find us on Spotify as well, and now on YouTube, so check us out there too. We're on Facebook at Remakers Mark, Twitter at Remakers Mark, and Instagram at Remakers Mark Podcast. So please join in the discussion there as well. So gents, in the meantime, please do not wring out your cats to get their oil. Really, all you have to do is just like put some tuna under a box and just let them sit, and it'll just take care of itself. So just keep that in mind. And until the next time where that happens to you, may the force be with you.
And also with you.